Hi everyone, it's Adam from Monkey Tennis here. Just saying a huge thank you to all of you that have supported my charity appeal so far. For those that haven't heard about it, this September I'm going to be swimming 15 kilometres between five islands in Cornwall. I'll be swimming the Isles of Scilly, that's Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. I'm doing it because I want to, but also to raise money for CALM, the campaign against living miserably. It's a well-known statistic that 125 people in the UK die by suicide every week, and CALM run a free and confidential helpline for people to speak through their problems and ultimately to help prevent suicides. I'm looking to raise enough money to train two new phone workers to man those lines, and I'll be doing it by swimming the Isles of Scilly in Cornwall. If you're looking to support me, it would be greatly appreciated. You can donate at justgiving.com. Just go there and search for Adam Swim Scilly. That's Adam Swim Scilly, S-C-I-L-L-Y. All donations greatly appreciated. Thank you for helping me to support CALM. And now, on with Monkey Tennis.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello everyone, Nick from Monkey Tennis here. We hope you've enjoyed this latest series of the podcast where we interview FOPs, that's fans of Partridge, on all things Alum. And as we close out the series, we thought what better time than now to share one of our favourite episodes, where we talk to Tim Key. So if you've missed it first time around, or are new to the show and yet to listen, please sit back and enjoy as Adam and Tom chat to Mr. Tim Key.
Hi Nick, are you bored of drinking big fat shots of Director's Bitter and Ladyboy Chasers at home?
Tom, I ruddy bloody am. I'm hopping mad and just want some exciting craft beers to enjoy when I'm watching my Bond videos. That's not too much to ask, is it?
Well, have I got some good news for you. The fantastic chaps at Beer 52 have given us a special offer they'd like us to share with our listeners.
Can I just shock you? I like special offers. Do tell me more.
All you need to do is go to beer52.com/monkeytennis, cover the postage cost of £5.95, and you'll be sent a box of 8 cracking craft beers, plus a magazine, and 2 beer-appropriate snacks.
Wow, that is a real breath of fresh air. So you're telling me to get a free case of 8 unique craft beers from Beer 52, I just need to go to beer52.com/monkeytennis and cover the postage costs of £5.95?
Yep, it's literally that simple. It really is lovely stuff.
Oh, sometimes you want to say, sod all this wine, just give me 8 craft beers.
And I've really got to say this, Nick, Beer 52 is the world's largest beer club.
Mmm.
Yep, each month members are sent a case with a different theme. Past themes have included Belgium, Korea, California, New Zealand and many more.
But what if I don't like dark beers?
They've got that covered too. If you don't like dark beer, you can choose a light beer option. And you can pause or cancel at any time. Simply go to beer52.com/monkeytennis and just pay £5.95 postage to get all this now.
Crash, bang, wallop, what an offer. 8 free beers, a magazine and 2 snacks for less than £6 postage. Mine's not a pint, mine's a box of 8 craft beers. I'll drink to that.
I am hopping mad and I want something in the middle.
Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Little pierce my foot on a spike.
With a chuckle, with a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzard of a guy.
Yes, 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 and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that? Like, this is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net. Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Hello and welcome to Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. I'm Adam Brooks and I'm joined by Tom Dark.
Bird it.
Nick Alder.
It was Jingle Genocide.
And Tom Stab.
Death to the West.
So, minor apologies to those of you expecting more of our episodes covering From the Oast House. We'll be picking those up in due course, but we're pausing them briefly for a very good reason, namely that we got to chat with one of our Partridge heroes, Mr. Tim Key, recently, and we wanted to bring you that interview unedited and in full. Well, probably edited a little bit. As well as being Psychic Simon, he's also been in Skins, The End of the Fucking World. He's done all sorts of stand-up. He's a renowned poet. And perhaps most recently, he's taken to YouTube to play No More Jockeys, which is a game created by him and his famous friends, Alex Horn and Mark Watson. They've been playing it weekly, and we talk about it quite a bit in the episode, so I thought I'd just briefly explain the rules. It's well worth playing at home. On each turn, players name a person plus a category they fall under. That person and category are then eliminated, and subsequent people must not fall under that category. As more categories are added, it gets harder and eventually impossible to name anyone new. So, for example, I could start by saying, Nick Alder, no more hosts of Monkey Tennis, and then you couldn't name any of us for the rest of the game, and then it would go over to someone else who might say, Andy Murray, no more sports people, and then it gets, as you see, progressively more difficult. But it's a great little pub game, and they play it themselves, Alex, Tim and Mark, between them on YouTube. So I thoroughly recommend you look that up because it is a lot of fun. And we do go into that as part of our extensive chat. So I always hate it when people waffle on when there's a good chat in the wings. So we're now going to hand over to my past self and Mr. Tom Stab. And of course, our special guest, Mr. Tim Key. So hello again, it's Adam and Tom Stab from Monkey Tennis here with our very special guest for today, poet, actor, writer, comedian, performer, presenter and polymath, Mr. Tim Key. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Adam. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Was that adequately grand? I was sort of listing all the things you've done and I feel like I've probably missed some things out.
There's no harm in going through them again a little slower.
Okay. Professional poet, obviously.
Yeah, I'll wave that through.
Okay. Actor?
Yeah, underrated.
Yeah. Writer, of course.
Sorry?
Writer?
Writer, yeah.
Comedian?
You've got to, you know, it sounds mad to say it, but, you know, you've got to back yourself.
Yeah, I think it's fair. Performer?
Yep, voiceover artist. What's your next one?
Oh, yes, didn't have voiceover artist. Should have had that. That's a big part of the puzzle.
Presenter? Quite up, actually.
Yeah. I've got presenter.
Now, that's good. I like the idea of that.
Well, I think No More Jockeys, you could argue that you're at least a presenter on of No More Jockeys, if nothing else.
I'd say that's a good early reassuring moment in the interview where it means you know who you're interviewing.
Yes.
That's surprising that you know No More Jockeys. I mean, that's a sleeper hit, to say the least.
Oh, well, there you go. It's rising through the ranks. I'm putting it in now because now I can claim when it becomes even more popular that it was down to this interview.
Tim, we've done 4 years doing deep dives on Alan Partridge. Like this is nothing. We do our research. We know our stuff.
Oh, don't get me wrong. I know about your show.
Uh-oh. We try to dive deep, but I mean, you know, obviously there's some things we can't know, and that's why we have to bring on experts in the subject. I mean, rounding off this list, I've put polymath, which I like just because it makes me sound smart, but also I feel like it's sort of wasting time to have said everything that comes before it, because polymath implies that you do all the other things.
Is that what polymath means?
I believe it's just sort of like a kind of a master of all trades,
doer
if you like.
Of things,
a Svengali of sorts.
I was wondering how you were going to use jack of all trades and not make it sound like I can't do any of them.
Master of all trades, I said master of all trades.
That's a very nice twist on it.
I've done my best. So, yes, I mean, it feels like we should start with an obligatory lockdown coronavirus question. We've talked a bit about the resurrection of No More Jockeys with your good friends Alex Horn and Mark Watson. That's obviously something that seems to have sprung out of lockdown, but has it also scuppered other things? I know you're deep in work on the Witchfinder as well. How has lockdown affected your what you've been up to?
I barely noticed it. we were filming Witchfinder, which is written by, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Gibbons brothers.
Briefly, they've come up on the pod.
Gibbons brothers, erstwhile of Partridge reboot of the last decade, they have written another comedy called Witchfinder, which is set in the world of witchfindery, sort of 17th century Essex, with me finding a witch and trying to transport her across Essex. And the witch is Daisy May Cooper. And we filmed a day.
Oh, no.
And I've got to say, on the way to work on the Monday, it didn't feel like we were going to get the full 10 weeks done.
No. But what a day.
Yeah.
It was a good day, yeah.
Did they get you on a horse in that day?
They didn't get me on a horse, no. They got us kissing, actually, funnily enough. So the only acting I've done with Daisy May Cooper so far is us kissing in a pub garden and then lockdown being called shortly afterwards. So to say we've got unfinished business barely covers it.
Very fair. Let's go back to the start and your sort of introduction into Partridge. I mean, IMDb, I know, is not the most reliable barometer of what anybody's done, but it does have your first acting credits as being Saxondale and Time Trumpet, respectively. So
it does.
It does. As acting roles.
That's a very, very... Yeah, that's cooking the books slightly. I'm sure that I've done some stuff that's slightly less cool before I did those.
I was surprised to see those as the first things, and I wondered whether you first crossed paths with Steve or whether it was with Armando, and how that sort of developed into you taking the role of Psychic Simon, because obviously you've done work with both of them before entering the realm of Partridge.
Yeah, I think this is going to feel a lot like a quiz, some of this interview.
It's been a while.
Yeah, just remember, you lived it. You lived it. There are no wrong answers.
You could just lie, make it up.
You two definitely know more about Partridge and more about me than I do. Can you just tell me which order those two things came? Then I might be able to work this out.
Saxondale was listed first, and Time Trumpet, I think, was listed immediately after.
Correct.
As far as I remember.
So I think the way it happened was I got cast in Saxondale to do a small bit, but I sort of feel like they were kind of it's like when in cricket someone gets an opportunity to play on the Lions tour so they can have a look at them. I feel like I like to think. They had a master plan of me coming into the Alan Partridge franchise down the line, but in actual fact, it was just a tiny part in Saxondale. But I know that they'd come and watched, or Lindsay had come and watched, who's one of the founding fathers of Baby Cow. They'd come and watch me in Edinburgh do a really small thing in someone else's show, and the way she tells it to me, anyway, is that she logged that at the time. And thought, I think this guy might be someone we can do business with. And that would have been in about 2003. And they did business with me about 4 years after that. So they kept it logged, really, rather than sort of moving into action on that for a bit.
So Saxondale was a sort of a bit of a trial for you. You were on trial. You had trials.
I had trials. Yeah, I had trials for Coogan. Feeder Club, Saxondale.
Yeah.
it was stressful. I mean, I'm sure we'll go on to talk about the Alan Partridge stuff, but it's probably the same thing there as happened with Partridge. Was I remember going for I'd been cast in it, but I went for a rehearsal, I think. I don't think it was an audition. But I remember going up in the lift at some production company, and I remember the lift doors opening, and he must have been doing a rehearsal of another scene, because I remember hearing his, to be fair, quite distinctive voice through the door. And yeah, it's quite kind of it's quite intimidating because, as you can imagine, and we'll probably move on to this, he's a kind of big hero of mine in terms of, you know, whenever anyone comes up to me and says, you know, I'm a massive Partridge fan, that's definitely my kind of background before working with him, was being an obsessive 18-year-old in the mid-90s, just listening and watching all of it. So it was quite odd 10 years later to be stood outside a door and be sort of on the threshold of working with him.
Mm. And it seems like the Gibbons brothers had not a dissimilar trajectory in that they were both fans of the original wave of Partridge too. So it's kind of like there's almost, I mean, it's, I guess it's testament to his endurance as a comedy character that you've got a generation of people who grew up on the first wave now heavily involved in the second.
Yeah, it's very neat. It's a good system that they've got there. It's a good industry with Partridge.
Absolutely. I mean, so in terms of Simon and the development of Simon, how much of that character did they have before they brought you in? Was it just that they knew Adam needed a foil, or did they say, we really want you involved in some way? What kind of character should that be? I'm curious kind of how fully formed the idea of Simon was before you stepped in.
So that happened where they... So that was all done, and the Saxondale thing was fine, you know, just sort of did a steady job at left back and pretty unspectacular. And then I don't know how much further down the line the Partridge stuff came. But yeah, I remember getting a call from my agent, and I was in Edinburgh, and I was sat next to another comedian in a cafe, and I didn't really say anything. My agent was just sort of going, right, there's this thing that's come in. Can you talk? And I was like, yes, I think so. And she said, well, they're bringing back Partridge, and they are interested in you being potentially a sidekick for him. And it's quite an interesting phone call to receive. And she said, well, you can't tell anyone yet because they're just still, you know, working out the finer details of that and how it's going to be. But it's looking like that's something that could happen. I remember putting the phone down and being sat next to David O'Doherty, another comedian, and him going, who's that? And me goes, well, my agent. Oh yeah, anything good? Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's maybe. But sort of deep down thinking, well, that's sort of quite an interesting thing. But yeah, in terms of whether it was to what extent they were sort of writing for me or anything like that, I'll be honest, I feel like they've kind of got a quite good handle on how to write for my guy. But I think at the time, he mainly just, you know, he's what you see on screen. He's like, he's out of his depth and he shouldn't be there. He's been accidentally deified by Partridge when actually he doesn't really have anything about him, least of all anything that would be useful on a radio show.
Yeah.
And so I'd say it's quite sort of underwritten in terms of like, if you're writing Partridge or if I'm writing Partridge, yet sort of writing Partridge. And so, and the nature of that show was, it was just incessant, like Mid-Morning Matters was just, and that was the beauty of it, the joy of it, was it's just Partridge. And it just is relentless and never ends and would be probably too much if there wasn't like a foil to bounce off. And so if you look at the scripts on paper, they're exactly how you'd expect them to be and exactly how they should be, with him saying stuff and occasionally me sort of either doing a weak joke or doing a something along the lines of, I don't know whether you should say that because we're on air type thing. And that would be the sort of rhythms of the whole thing. So in terms of how then that fed into my character developing, I think there was just enough there for me to be able to chip in sometimes. And then the rest of it, I think, for me, was done by the actual situation being so horrifically similar in real life to how it was in terms of on the page, as in I was petrified.
you both, you and Simon have a bit of have a healthy dose of deference to Steve or Alan.
Yeah, I really do believe that was what was going on. I had an enormous amount of imposter syndrome, an enormous amount of I do not want to screw this up, an enormous amount of it's nice that he's asked me to do this, but I don't want to ruin this guy's career. And so Simon and Tim Key were both sort of thinking the same thing, I think, which is, I don't know why I'm here particularly. And so it felt like apart from the fact that I'm, in terms of as an actor or performer, it's very rare I do anything where it's kind of anything other than some kind of version of me. I'm not like a sort of Tom Hardy figure, I wouldn't say. I'm not saying that people are saying that about me, but I hold my hands up. I sort of try and play myself to a greater or lesser degree. So, in a way, that sort of real uneasiness, that sort of bag of nervousness was probably what you see on screen. And I was frankly petrified, of mucking it up. And I remember walking out of the first day of filming, feeling pretty sick. Oh God, it's really difficult. And that always, although it became much more comfortable as that first series went on, it never went. And in the second series of Mid Morning Matters, it was still there, I think. And I think the first day of filming on this time was really, more petrifying than ever. And then I think I really settled after that first day, and that became probably one of the least concerned I've been. But still, it's all there. It's all in my chest. This feeling of uneasiness is all very, very easy to sort of reach for in a way that, method actors have to sort of try and remember something tragic in their life to bring on the tears. I'm having to remember what it's like to work in the Partridge franchise to feel that anxious. That's the same feeling now when in this time I hear those great big clomping shoes walking across the studio towards me. And it feels like it's a very natural thing for my character to sort of go almost sort of on the verge of under his breath going, oh Christ.
He's going to ask me to operate this digiwall again.
Exactly.
It kind of sounds like Psychic Simon was the role you were born to play in that regard.
Yeah. Well, I would always say Hamlet.
I mean, one thing you mentioned there about how Mid Morning Matters is kind of pure Partridge, and you needed that kind of foil to bounce off, because it's such a insular experience of watching him just basically in that one room. I think that's kind of why, having covered this podcast for about 4 years, the revenance that Mid Morning Matters has with the audience of and fans of Partridge, because it is almost like we've mentioned it on the podcast before, kind of like pure Partridge. It's Alan at his most sort of immediate, and there's very few other characters for him to bounce off. So it as a returning vehicle for Partridge, quite a bold move to really focus on him and that character. So I think that's kind of, does it hold sort of similar esteem for you, really, I guess? Because one of the questions we wanted to ask you is, like, what was your earliest Alan memory, and how did you sort of discover him, and versus what you're doing in the Partridge universe now? Do you think that basically what is being done now is as good as anything that's happened before?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I feel like it is, but I feel like it's quite difficult to judge it, the stuff that I'm in. So I always find it like really mad when people say that they really like that one as an incarnation, because I think it's great, but I do find it much easier to kind of just sort of swim around in watching something that I'm not in terms of Partridge. But I do think it holds up, because the other stuff that that I watch that's contemporary with it, but that I'm not in, like the audiobook, or well, the book and the audiobook that accompanies it, and the specials, you know, where he's sort of floating around England. I love those, and so it's slightly easier for me to sort of judge because I'm not in those, and that's from nowadays. But I don't know. It's difficult to know, isn't it? Because I have a lot of affection for the stuff from 25 years ago, definitely, and the stuff that I used to. My sort of gateway Partridge was the Radio 4 show. Well, and On the Hour as well, but you know, I think On the Hour was just sort of floating around somewhere, and I would catch it sometimes, but I don't know, there's a limit to how much Radio 4 you're sort of slavishly listening to when you're 15 or 16 or something. But then I think that the tapes of Know Me, Knowing You came out, or the CDs, whatever era this was, and blue touch paper was lit, because then you could listen to them again and again and again, and then that was kind of something which kind of, you know, became sort of obsessive, gets in your head, and you're sort of quoting it at school and stuff like that. So obviously I haven't watched the Mid-Morning Matters ones more than once or twice, I don't think, but that stuff I've probably listened to, well, I mean, back then, I don't know, like all the time I was listening to that stuff and then just quoting it with friends from school and things. And then you just had this slew of that stuff because they were so prolific, and it was all felt to me like they didn't make any wrong turns. They just kept on making that stuff. And then, you know, you're only 6 months away from the TV one coming out, and then another 6 months and you've got the day to day, or, you know, I don't know the sequence of things, but it felt like it was all coming pretty thick and fast and was all just insanely different from other stuff.
Yeah. I think that the radio series finished in about January, 92. And then, the TV show started, I think, 93. And then I think the TV of, Know Me, Knowing You started that September. So it was a very quick, very, very quick turnaround.
So yeah, it's kind of mind boggling how quickly they were pumping it out.
Was anything from the part, did you take anything from, I mean, do you still watch those old series, I guess? And was there anything that you took from, I guess, kind of an encyclopedic knowledge of those, that early output, that was useful for sort of now?
No.
But
I think that would have been quite, that's a good idea though. I should have done. No, I feel like if I'm sort of suddenly, you know, bringing up some character or reference from his days in the Travel Lodge, then... But I feel like probably my character doesn't know anything about all of that stuff. I don't... I think he probably wasn't that aware, maybe, of what Partridge had done in his life. I mean, obviously, he's not privy to anything from I'm Alan Partridge, because in the world, that has not been broadcast. But I guess he could have, like, to be honest, it's more of a question for the Gibbonses, and I'm sure they did do this, particularly writing the book, where they're probably having to just, I mean, I imagine they're going out of their minds, because I imagine they're having to watch and listen to all of it and probably read loads of it and then work out how it all fits together.
Yeah, and then, what exists in Alan's world and what exists in the real world. Exactly. We have trouble with this too.
Yeah, and I don't know how it all fits. And then they're sort of slightly dependent on the people at the time fitting it together properly. And I've got no idea what, you know, how fastidious they were back in the day with making sure that Alan's O-levels stood up across, you know, three different incarnations of him.
So you weren't necessarily privy to any discussions about this new era of Partridge and what should be carried over from the Armando years over into the Gibbons years?
No, absolutely not. No, they were quietly in some kind of, you know, weird sort of room somewhere with Steve and just rebooting. Mm. I don't know. I wasn't part of. I wasn't brought in for any of that. I was just there on the day to read the script out, and then, you know, there was always, you know, there's stuff that you sort of have an observation you want to make, then they're very receptive to it. But I think, yeah, those three is a pretty powerful old team, I think, because they've got an insane grasp of it all, the brothers. And then Steve has got a pretty good handle on Alan Partridge, I think, as well.
I mean, another thing we've said on the podcast is that it would be so easy for them to rehash those old catchphrases and old personality traits. It's, you know, putting a new spin on it. You know, otherwise, you know, you will have, same with music, you have people saying, like, we just want to hear the old songs, but the artists and the musicians themselves want to do the new stuff. And it's kind of, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to rehash that old material when you can do something new? I think that's testament to Steve and the Gibbons that they have achieved that across multiple formats, books, TV, Mid-Morning Matters, etc. Like, their output has been nothing short of amazing, really, I think, because it would have been so easy for it to be just the same.
I think that's right. I feel like, yeah, it's finding a balance. I'm sure that they probably are constantly finding this, where you want stuff that's very, very Alan. And I mean, just in terms of being privy to conversations and, you know, meetings and things, I think Alan is probably the main adjective that floats around in those things. And Steve is kind of the high priest of Alan. They've got a good handle on Alan. I haven't got a bad handle on Alan, and obviously you two will have got an amazing handle on Alan. But it's quite good that they've got Steve there as the ultimate Alan arbiter, who it goes through him as a sort of as a last thing, even though he's heavily involved with writing it with them and stuff like that. When it comes to being on set, it goes through him one final time. So there's no chance really of anything un-Alan happening. But yeah, it's that balance between making sure Alan is doing stuff where, as a fan watching, you're thinking, that's good stuff. That's exactly what Alan would do. Or that's exactly what Alan would eat. Or that's exactly the kind of magazine Alan would flip through, without ever kind of resorting back to suddenly there's a big plate or something, and it's like a nice nod to something from a different series. You know, I'm sure they do that loads in the book, but I feel like when it's not... I think the book is a real kind of... there's tons of stuff for the fans and stuff where, you know, it's even names that you'd forgotten, or, you know, stuff that's happened on the TV that's being told as an anecdote is very good fun. But I think when they're making the new stuff, I think you just have a sort of walking, talking Alan, and just sort of stick things to him that are sort of new, I think.
It feels like it's he's endured as a character so much because they're really smart at telling the difference between what's an Alan characteristic that a fan could guess or a fan could write, and what's an Alan characteristic that nobody's ever thought about before.
Right. Well, yeah. There's a good example, I think, is when he came back and he had his glasses around his neck on a chain. And I remember seeing that for the first time and just thinking, that is perfect Alan. And that's an Alan who's like 20 years older, and, you know, I think that's kind of the point with Alan is, I don't know, like he's just kind of so sort of strong-minded and so clear in his choices that he makes, and it's just insane how many of them are wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been talking about the two different eras of Partridge as if you're a newcomer to it. But, I mean, you've been playing the role of Simon for a decade now. I wondered, as that role's continued, we've obviously started to learn a little bit more about Simon's life. So there's, you know, the references to his adoption, his relationship with Lucy in this time. I wondered how much of a full backstory for Simon exists somewhere, or are these just details that are added to the script as we go along? I mean, is there a piece of paper somewhere that has all of his movements up to and including his time with Alan, or is it not that fully fleshed out?
Oh, very good. The Simon dossier.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
No, I don't think there is. I think I just don't think he's got that much about him, and you know, he's. I don't. There's not really. He's so sort of, you know, steady and kind of vanilla and kind of unexceptional that I think a moment where he's kind of able to just sort of really surprise people, or I mean, I can sort of see it, you know, in this time or something like that. I'm sure I can sort of imagine him doing something, and someone else normal, i.e., not Alan, could sort of see a side of him that Alan would never really have noticed or something like that. But I don't know. In a way, it doesn't really. I don't know. It doesn't really need that. I think he sort of. There's so many kind of eccentric people that he sort of surrounds himself with, and there's just this one person in the middle who's I don't know. I mean, I just find it funny that it, you know, there's not tons going on with him, I don't think.
Yeah, I mean, it almost kind of highlights the vanilla-ness of Simon, I guess, that when he does start to show a little bit more depth, or like, for example, the story where he starts talking about trying to meet his biological parents, that it's cut off immediately anyway. So even if there was an avenue out of the vanilla for Simon, it's cut off by Alan because it's getting in the way of Alan's agenda. So you're never gonna see it.
I know. So I guess that part of the humour of the character is the just sort of mind-boggling, where has Alan's faith in this guy come from?
Yeah.
And he talks about, you know, going to the pub and stuff and saying, this guy was electric. And you just can't, you can't picture that scenario, really. Partly because my guy doesn't have enough about him to command a pub table and you know, slam down the next round of drinks and say something cheeky, and they're on again to the next 20 minutes of, you know, howling with laughter. You can't really imagine that, but also you'd think Alan would shut down anything where his drinking companion isn't just listening to his stories.
Yeah, well, but also it highlights a trait of Alan's, because Alan's got previous in this regard for promising a slot to Max Beasley and Cheeky Monkey on Knowing Me, Knowing You. So it's not the first time he's sort of seen a sort of an average guy, or an entry level entertainer, and thought, this guy's got a huge promise, I'm going to give him a massive break.
Yeah, he did it in he did it in the radio show as well.
The Jewish comedian.
Yeah, you were so funny last night. He's a bad judge, I think.
Yeah.
On the whole, of more or less everything. But sort of one of the enduring things about him is that, you know, there is something funny. Even about that, you kind of are thinking there's a whole kind of image there that it draws, where you're you're in a comedy club, you're thinking about this comedy club, you're thinking about this guy who clearly is bad, and you're wondering what the reaction of the room was, and whether it is sort of pin drop silence and Alan just in his own little world just chuckling away at this guy, thinking this guy is fantastic. He's got a sort of, you know, element of wanting to be loved and stuff like that, but he really is a completely loose cannon who will just sort of have his own very, very firmly held views on things, which invariably sort of completely unfathomable. And I think that's, Simon fits very neatly into that. I mean, he's literally like, you know, gone through the papers with this guy in the pub and just thought, this guy should be on my radio show. And it's not the joke, I think, in a lot of sitcoms would be he then regrets it. But instead, it's this constant, you know, dialogue and this kind of every time this kind of really anxious feeling from part and watching it of him thinking, do well, please do as well as 8 years ago in the pub, please find that from somewhere.
You see that in this time, definitely, at the Digiwall. Like, you really see that, some of those sort of excruciating exchanges where it goes wrong, you can see Alan wants it to go well. Now, that could be arguably because he just wants it to go well for his own benefit, but if Simon does well, Alan does well. So,
well, also there's this inexplicable thing, which I think that they all find quite amusing as well, which is there isn't anything in this time where anything is explained as to why I'm on there.
Yeah.
At some point, you're led to believe that the fictional producers of this time have put Alan on, and then Alan has gone to a meeting somewhere and said, now there's one other there's one other condition here. I've got a guy who, frankly, excuse my language, is ruddy fantastic, and they haven't done their checks, and they haven't, you know, watched his internet radio show to check what the hell he's talking about, and they've just signed this guy up. So, I mean, I'm sure that as the producers are watching the show, I don't understand why we've got this guy doing this. My guy shouldn't be there. And the bigger the show, the more he shouldn't.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yes, this is, he's sort of travelled with Alan through Mid Morning Matters and Out of Paper and now this time. Yeah, I mean, it does seem like, again, Alan's got previous for taking people with him, doesn't necessarily want the best man for the job, but wants the most familiar. Yeah. And that's how Michael ends up running security at Shape, I guess, as well. You know, not the best security guard, but a known presence, someone that Alan's got some control over, I guess. I mean, talking about the difference between Mid Morning Matters, Alpha Papa, and this time, was there, I mean, obviously they're all very different properties, and that's one of the great things about Alan, is moving through all these different media. But how are the experiences of making them different from each other? Was one particularly big on time pressure? Did one have more room for improv? Or, you know, kind of how did the sort of the Partridge machine work differently when making a film to making BBC One TV show to making a web series?
Oh, right. Well, the film, you have less time, obviously, because it's a bigger sort of machine. And I suppose on paper, Mid Morning Matters, you should have more time because the setup is so, simple. It's just two fixed cameras. But, you know, the nuances of the working day in terms of there's rewriting and things. I suppose the... You do have more time, but I suppose that the work fills the time you've got. And so a lot of that time is used to sharpen scripts and things like that, or even to just, you know, get rid of something and rewrite. So that was happening quite a lot on Mid Morning Matters. And yeah, like I said, the first day of this time, I thought maybe, because it's a bigger thing than the Mid Morning Matters, I was kind of quite sort of pleasantly surprised at how I would say it's the one I think it's the one I enjoyed most, actually. And I think, I don't know why that is. Maybe a certain, I don't know, actually, no idea. But that's definitely the one where there was the most improvisation, I think. And by improvisation, I don't really mean, you know, throwing in a massive curveball or anything like that. I feel like, because I don't think that that is my role, I feel like the whole point of my guy is to serve Partridge as he just moves through into his next bit of the show. It's just sort of, I'm there just to kind of, again, like be a foil as he kind of, as things fall apart around him and stuff like that. But even so, I found it really enjoyable that the kind of, you know, very small, you know, noises and, you know, the sort of minutiae of having those exchanges with Steve was really enjoyable, I thought. And I don't know, maybe because the scenario is higher stakes, there's a camera on us, and it's the conceit is that it's live and it's got a big audience, and the nervousness and anxiety that we talked about before is all there. And yeah, I don't know. I found it kind of quite, those little kind of 3 or 4 minute little dances, I found them quite enjoyable. So yeah, they're all quite different, I think. But yeah, I mean, I guess there's also an element of kind of enjoying the one that you're on the most. And I suppose there's also an element of, you know, it's a slightly different thing to walk in and be acting alongside your hero, you know, 10 years ago, to just kind of going to work and doing, working with someone who, you know, you obviously you've worked with for a long time now.
Do you think maybe it's partly because you have been playing that character for 10 years now, so there is that familiarity with it? You said that kind of nervousness never really goes away, but you've had 10 years to be with this character now, so the most recent thing is probably going to be the most enjoyable because of that familiarity with the character, do you think?
There's that. And also, I suppose, there's also, I guess you can't really underestimate the random factor of the digiwall. Which keeps you sharp, certainly. I mean, the digiwall is a nightmare, and that flows into the acting the person who's having a nightmare with technology quite well.
So that was quite easy to act against then?
It definitely would have been more difficult to act that I could use the digital.
I think the question that the most important question I think we have here, and something that's, you know, we really want to dig deep on, is the thing that everyone talks about. It's Psychic Simon's fashion choices, his t-shirts. How many of those t-shirts are yours?
One.
Which one?
Oh God.
There was the one where he has a map on his shirt, which is a particular favourite of
not mine.
Not yours.
Not yours. Next.
There's one with an owl pun that doesn't work on it.
That's mine.
Okay.
That's
what's the, what's, I mean, I don't know. Are these, presumably they're chosen by a wardrobe person, but is there a criteria? Is there something that makes a t-shirt Simon appropriate?
Well, I mean, you know, you go quite deep on Partridge. It doesn't seem like it's going to be beyond you to get her on.
No,
it's a very delicate thing. You know, all of that stuff. You know, when you come into it, that all of that stuff is all sort of up and running, and there's a lot of thought, obviously, that goes into Alan's stuff. But obviously, a similar amount of thought goes into, you know, Lynn or Michael or you know, whoever. So yeah, I have no idea how they made all those choices, because they'd have seen a script, I guess, of Mid Morning Matters before they started making those choices. But I mean, I think the idea is just, broadly speaking, somewhere in between unexceptional and naff. I mean, I'd sometimes wear my own jeans and stuff like that, but you know, even that is taking a bit of a liberty, because I think his jeans are even naffer than, I mean, I'm not wearing nice jeans. Don't worry about that. But this guy is, if I'm wearing stuff that they've picked out, it's naffer.
And then
there's often his sort of calling card. He doesn't mind a shirt over a t-shirt, which is not necessarily my MO.
I remember, I can't remember what it was. I think it might have been an outtake or just a behind-the-scenes clip of Steve during Mid-Morning Matters with his feet up on the desk, and he requests a change of socks because the socks that he's wearing are not Alan's socks. Alan wouldn't be wearing those kind of socks. So he says to someone off-screen, can I get a different pair of socks? Because I don't think Alan would be wearing these socks. So that level of attention to detail goes into Alan, obviously, but then I imagine it goes into all the characters.
Yeah, I think it does. I think there's a lot of that going around. I think probably in terms of the detail of costumes, once it gets to socks, I think Simon is pretty safe in most socks.
Right, okay.
But then again, it's probably fair to say if Simon puts his feet up on a desk, then, you know, you have to remember these people are good at their jobs, you know, all the different departments, and there would definitely be, you know, when it's your job to dress these people, they'll be looking at those socks thinking, they're not the socks I gave him earlier. Any job you go to, you always are given socks.
Yeah, if you're spotted as wearing your own socks, they're going to think you're a prima donna. This guy's not, won't take order. Like, get him off the set. He doesn't take his sock game seriously.
I'm trying to think if, I mean, Simon's might have been naff socks. I mean, obviously, usually when you're given socks for most jobs, that they tend to be like, just a pair of socks. It wouldn't surprise me if, I mean, you know, Simon seems like the kind of guy who wouldn't be afraid of a Homer Simpson sock.
Yeah, definitely, I agree.
Yep, or socks for each day of the week, but wearing them on the wrong days, just to be arch.
Yeah, left and right, same principle.
Tim, you can if you play Simon again, you can have that one. We'll let you have that one.
I'll go ahead. I'll just empty a bin bag on my first day.
So, I mean, we've kind of spoken about past Alan and, you know, the eras and the transition of kind of how Alan has developed and what's stayed with the character and what's kind of been left behind a little bit. Do you think, I mean, we've kind of touched on you not thinking there's particularly much depth to Simon. Do you think there's kind of been any evolution in him as a character, or he's changed, and his relation to Alan, I guess, like, him coming in from the beginning, like, why am I here? Is he actually a little bit more confident in this time, but it still goes wrong? Like, do you think there has been any kind of evolution with him?
Yeah, I feel like I need to talk to the Gibbons about this, because I don't want them listening to this podcast, and the main thing I keep saying is that my character lacks any depth.
Those are my words. I said that, so they can be mad at us.
Well, I totally agree, but I think they don't. No, I feel like he's just been swept along. But, you know, in this guy's, I mean, it's almost the definition of shirt tails, what Simon has done. I mean, he is at heart a lab technician. So, I mean, I don't know if he's still keeping that up or whether he's now. I mean, it is, in a way, it's quite an interesting thing to happen to you to suddenly be on effectively the One Show, and in other news, no interest at all about being on the One Show. I mean, the guy is, I think the guy rolls with the punches, to be fair. In terms of what else is happening in his life, I don't know. I mean, there was like a sort of moment of a suggestion that maybe there was something going on between him and one of the people on set.
Yeah, at the very least, a Doctor Who podcast.
Yeah, something where we've been talking, something where you think maybe this guy talks to someone over a styrofoam cup at some point. But no, other than that, I don't know. Maybe in the next incarnation, there'll be some kind of, you know, heavy hitting. You know, some TV shows just go and follow one character, a different character, one episode, don't they?
You're looking for a spin-off, that's what I'm hearing.
One episode.
I mean, that kind of brings...
Sidekick Simon, without Partridge there, would be, I would say, almost impossible to watch.
It's sort of like, it's kind of like if Garth from Wayne's World had his own show.
I think it might be more difficult to watch than that.
Wow.
I mean, on that note, we should get to, you've kindly said we can ask a few questions from listeners and stuff as well. But before we get to that, What's next for Sidekick Simon? I appreciate there's probably a level of secrecy around this, but there's been talk of a second series of this time being in the pipeline. Are you able to say whether Simon is back for that, or are there other Partridge projects you're in the frame for, or is it all very much under wraps at the moment, or unknown?
I don't know, actually.
Very diplomatic.
I mean, you hear these things, don't you? I'm sure they've got something up their sleeve, these guys.
And is this a character that you really, you know, you'd love to carry on playing? Do you have a lot of affection for Simon? And one of those things is, like, as long as there's Partridge and a need for Simon, like, your willingness and excitement for him?
Yeah. I mean, I reckon. The thing is, it's almost, it's like a no-brainer where you kind of think, all of the scripts for everything I've done with Partridge have just been all kind of impeccable. Mm-hmm. I feel like if they brought back Partridge and the writing had been terrible and I'm reading it thinking, oh Christ, this is going to be a disaster. I think, to be fair, I'm still saying yes. I think it's impossible to not say yes, because not that I am necessarily ever likely to meet my 16-year-old self. I think that would be a big problem if I met my 16-year-old self and his main thing is, I'm sorry, you turned what down? And then once you're doing it, you know, then you've got a bunch of, like I say, the last thing I did with it was my favourite. So, and also all the kind of cliches of the, you know, the family, you know, that's what people say, isn't it? When there's an award or something, they say, you know, we're like a family. I wouldn't say we are like a family, but it's always enjoyable to go back and, you know, I really like Steve and the writers are fantastic. And crucially, the scripts are really good. So, yeah, I think I can't really imagine a bit where you sort of go, I think I'm out. I'm sure there must be an example of a footballer who says, you know,
Eric Cantona?
Yeah, actually, to be fair, I think Anelka might have done that once or twice with some bigger clubs, and maybe his big country as well. Where I feel like it would be quite an insane chapter in my life. The bit where I say, you know what, guys, I think I've got bigger fish to fry. But then again, you know, hopefully I will have, and I can get rid of it.
So we'll wrap up with a couple of listener questions. I think we've got one from Elliot Mayer here. So we've kind of covered this. The question is, what's your favourite Partridge moment or era? We've kind of covered your sort of favourite era, but is there a sort of moment or scene or guest on one of the early radio series that was the thing that you quoted the most, the thing that you found the funniest or that you remember? I mean, that could be a scene from the later sitcom era as well.
I would say, I mean, almost all of that radio show, but I mean, you know, there's a line that me and my main Partridge friend in arms at sixth form, we used to say, who are the bishops, quite a lot, which is a reference to the hostages in the radio show, the kind of the people have been sort of locked to each other and have had dismal time because they've fallen out. And I think at one point Partridge calls them pawns in a game of cruel chess. And then there's a big pause and then they might have even moved on a bit. And then Partridge says, who are the bishops? So I would say maybe those two. Hang on, I think he's called Phil Collins, isn't he, that guy?
Yes, yeah, he is. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But actually, that's the most, in terms of like formative Partridge stuff. But I would say in terms of just one that I would go back to and just watch, if I'm taking 1.5 hour of Partridge, I think it probably would be one of the episodes of I'm Alan Partridge series one, I would imagine. Maybe the one with the angry farmers in, so you get a bit of Chris Morris there as well.
Lovely. Tom, I'm going to skip to the end because I've just spotted my favourite question and I'm aware we're a bit tight for time.
Go for it.
Patrick Dukes asks, you're quarantining with Steve Coogan, but you both have to be in character as Alan and Simon for the whole 3 months, which would include Steve wearing the wig and you wearing shirts with maps of the country on them. How long do you think you could go without breaking character, or who do you think would break first?
Oh, right. I don't think we're going that long. What is the sort of punishment for breaking character? Feels like if there's no real sort of tariff, I reckon we're probably breaking quite early.
Yeah, Patrick hasn't introduced any punitive measures for breaking character, so
I feel like I can probably stay in character for longer in terms of there's not really much to stay in. He can sort of float around and it's all sort of fine, and it's more of a hassle for Steve. But then again, I feel like Steve's got more, you know, heavy artillery to draw on in terms of how partridgey he can become and remain. I don't want to lift the lid on him, and I'm sure you probably are aware of this anyway, but he doesn't stay in character on set. He's not a sort of Suchet Poirot type thing. But even so, it's kind of still, it's quite incessant, because although he doesn't break character, he obviously doesn't change out of his costume and makeup in between scenes. So if you sort of see him floating around a corridor or sitting on set, he's Partridge.
Yeah, I mean, there's something that Armando said, I think, back when he was more involved with the writing, that the worst thing about writing Partridge is having to spend that long in a room with Alan, you know, his character hanging in the air, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly right. He's a presence.
So are you quite relieved when you finish rapping on an Alan project, because you're like, oh, I get a break from this guy? Not Steve, obviously, but like the character of Alan.
I'd say with Mid-Morning Matters, that could be quite intense. I suppose the first series where you're not used to it and there's quite a lot of them. I think you're in all, you've got to remember, it's hard enough anyway, but when the actual nature of the shoot is that you're in a very small radio, and we did shoot it in the first series at a sound studio. So actually you are in a small room and you are in there with this monster and you just have these two. I mean, usually at least there's just someone else just sort of sharing the atmosphere and breathing the same air as you. There's like a boom operator and people moving cameras around and stuff like that. But with this one, they'll close the door, and the door to a sound studio is famously soundproof and heavy. So this door kind of clicks shut, and that is your working day, just being in a room with, there's no two ways about it, Alan Partridge. And so, yeah. Yeah, it does fry your brain.
I think we can sort of wrap up there. I guess this is a chance, if there's anything that you specifically wanted to plug or anything that you want people to be aware of, or what, obviously we've spoken about Witchfinder, but is there anything else that, you know, for people to check out that you'd like? Because obviously with no Edinburgh this year, I don't know if you're planning on going, but like, is there anything out there for people to see you in or that you'd like to promote?
Well, Adam already said, no more jockeys.
Uh-huh. No more jockeys. What I love about more jockeys...
Since I'm in my study, I do have a pack of cards.
Oh, the poetical playing cards.
Yeah, so I wouldn't mind, like, what I can do, actually. I've got a... I don't know. I've got a jingle.
If you like playing cards and you like poetry, if you like things that look nice and you like tin key, then it may just be that we have found the perfect thing for you. The lovely deck of playing cards with poems on them too. Tin keys, poetical playing cards. Tin keys, poetical playing cards. Tin keys, poetical playing cards. From arteandpress.co.uk.
These are them. I don't know whether I can open them particularly, but I've got an open pack here. But this is my designer, really, you know, she's an absolute fiend with the old sort of waxy paper. And they're just, they're 52 sort of playing cards with my poems on them. Beautifully designed by Emily Juniper.
A lovely artifact.
And those are available from...
That's available from just should be Amazon, shouldn't it? No, it's available from her website, which is called utterandpress.co.uk. And you know, she just sort of packages them beautifully and sends them out. I mean, I suppose usually when you ask someone what they want to plug, they're probably in a film.
Well, Tim, this is the problem with being a polymath, you see. At the moment, it's a pack of playing cards. Previously it's been a book, or an Edinburgh show, or a sound recording, or a radio play.
There's something quite good about being a polymath in lockdown. So the chickens come home to roost slightly, where you can sort of move into a different realm of your polymathery.
Yeah, you can dust off your YouTube game show and off you run.
Yeah, I'm not sure it was meant to be a YouTube game show, but that's where we are.
I mean, it seems like it's just such a beautiful format. Is No More Jockeys as a game? Is that something that, because you obviously know the other two guys that you do it with for a very long time, is that something that existed before any of you did kind of comedy, or is the concept for No More Jockeys something that's come along the way?
Right at the start, it was in 2002, and me and Mark were writing a show together, I think, and broke, you know, all that sort of stuff in a sort of hovel somewhere in London. And we just started naming names. I think it started because someone said, I bet I could name 1,000 famous people. And the other person said, right, I could probably name 10,000. And the other person said, right, go on then. And then we sort of made a cup of tea and started naming. And then I think someone then started going, okay, look, this is insane. No more footballers. And so that was the sort of the germ of it. And then we said, no, this is no more actors. And then the game had started. And we've always played it. And with Alex as well. And when me and Alex were touring and stuff. And then last year, me and Mark went to Tokyo together. And it was good fun. It was a real kind of, you know, reconnection. And we were just sort of floating around the streets of Tokyo playing that game. And then lockdown happened. And we started it quite late in lockdown. But yeah, Mark just sent an email saying, maybe we should play this game again over Zoom. And luckily we've got Alex in our ranks who can just go, I can sort that. I can make that all happen, you know, in terms of getting it technically to work. But it's quite funny because there's another guy, Haimin, who edits it, who's fantastic. But it's quite funny because I feel like we've thought about it a bit, and you know, you sometimes think maybe that's a game for Radio 4 or something like that. But it's been great doing it on YouTube because it is the perfect marriage of that format is perfect for it. And we just, I mean, it's been a real highlight of lockdown where we just meet up every Thursday night, late at night, and just have those three screens. And when we first edited it, we put whoever's talking went big, but we got rid of that because it's just kind of quite nice to have Mark saying some absolute garbage or whatever, and then me and Alex just sort of looking at each other. What the hell's he talking about? Yeah, so it's been great. It's been a real high.
It's one of those formats that it's so much fun as a YouTube show. I can see why it originally was a TV format as well. But it also just feels, I hope it's not faint praise to say that it feels like it could be one of the most enduring pub games of all time. You know,
we really like it when people, you know, come back to us and say, and they start to in the comments underneath and stuff, they like are saying, yeah, we play this now every week. And yeah, that is really nice. I guess that's the point of it, really, is to sort of get people playing it and stuff like that. I mean, you know, we'd play it you know, a lot, you know, but, you know, just not, that's the thing. I feel like if the technology was there in lockdown to play that game, but you couldn't record Zoom, then I think we still would have played it 12 weeks straight anyway, definitely. And then, yeah, it's Alex and Hymen's genius to kind of cut it down and make it look like something that someone would potentially watch. But yeah, it's been fun to do.
Well, yeah, it's been one of the unexpected treats of lockdown. So thanks very much for that.
Oh, that's very kind of you.
And thanks very much for joining us. I think we're about, I mean, we could talk forever. We haven't even touched on Radio 4 series and so on, but that's the danger of being a polymath. We can't talk about it all. Thank you very much for joining us, Tim Key.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Tim. So there we go. That was our interview with Tim Key. The original plan was actually to put that at the end of the current series of Oast House. But after the interview, as you've just heard, was so good, we decided not to sit on it and let you guys hear it as soon as possible. One thing that wasn't included in the chat, actually, is that after we finished recording, we carried on chatting with Tim for about another 10 or so minutes. And he actually revealed to us that he is a Monkey Tennis listener of sorts. He listened to the podcast in its early incarnation, sort of, I think, series two, when he was traveling in Asia, Japan specifically. So that was nice to hear that Tim's actually listened to the podcast. So if you're listening now, Tim, thank you very much for your time.
Yeah, he said that when he was out in Asia, he was looking for a bit of quintessential Britishness or Englishness, which is why he ended up listening to the Monkey Tennis podcast, of all things. So yeah,
that's us.
As British as fish and chips.
Well, either way, yeah, it was a fantastic chat, and yeah, to have an icon of Partridge on the show was such a huge honour. So a big thank you to Mr. Tim Key.
Yeah, just to basically echo exactly that, that was a great interview. I mean, it was just genuinely a great thing to listen to, very insightful, and yeah, just great that Tim was so generous with his time with us as well. I think Adam and Tom probably had over an hour with him in the end, so yeah. Genuinely lovely stuff.
Yes, and thank you to so many of you that got in touch with your questions for Tim in advance. I'm afraid we didn't get through quite as many as we liked because we did such a deep dive on his time as Psychic Simon, but thanks to everyone who got in touch. If you'd like to get in touch with a question for us, or maybe even some kind of speculative future guest, then we're on Instagram at Monkey Tennis Pod, Twitter at The Partridge Pod, facebook.com/The Partridge Pod. You can email thepartridgepod@gmail.com or leave us a voice note to be featured in a future episode, if it's good enough, on 07923 600 017. That's the Monkey Tennis hotline. If you like what you heard and you enjoyed our chat with Tim or our other episodes so far, you can also shout us the price of a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/monkeytennis, and we very much appreciate your contributions helping us bring Partridge to you now and forevermore. That's all for this week, so thank you for listening. Thanks again to Tim Key for taking part, and we will see you next time on Monkey Tennis, the Alan Partridge fan podcast. Thanks and goodbye.
Bird it.
I am hopping mad, and I want something in the middle. Aha!
Yep, absolutely. Yep, absolutely.
Monkey tennis?
Bring, bring.
There's a new chat in town.
I had the last laugh.
Dan!
Monkey tennis?
Lil' pierce my foot on this thing.
With a chuckle.
No.
Monkey tennis?
Radical. Awesome. Mega.
Monkey tennis?
Where's my assistant? I do not know.
Okay.
Monkey tennis?
Edmonds is a total wazzup of a guy.
Yes, and yes.
It's hotter than the sun.
I said, who the hell is that?
This is great banter.
Yeah.
Back of the net. Monkey tennis?
The people who enjoy Alan Partridge will enjoy this podcast. The people who've never got it still won't get it.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.